The following podcast is for healthcare professionals only. All views expressed belong to our speakers and don't necessarily reflect those of Nestlé Health Science.
Hello and welcome to Inside Medical Nutrition Podcast, a podcast powered by Nestlé Health Science and hosted by me, Dr. Nia Patel. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Roseanne Mayer, a pediatric dietitian. We'll be discussing the cow's milk-related symptom score, COMIS, and how can healthcare professionals be more aware of the symptoms and the diagnosis of cow's milk allergies. Hi, Roseanne. Thank you so much for coming to the podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about COMIS. We're going to go into that in much more detail, but I must admit, even though I'm a dietitian, it's something that I don't know much about, so I'm really looking forward to getting educated on this. But to start off, Roseanne, why don't you tell us a little bit about you? So what made you get into dietetics, and specifically, why did you become a specialist pediatric dietitian?
Thank you, Linnea, and it's amazing to be able to talk about COMIS, which is that topic I'm so passionate about. And I think passion is really the background to why I got into all of this. I think I'm a pediatric dietitian, but my primary caseload isn't food allergy per se in pediatrics only. So I take children, I would say, up till 16, but the vast majority of my patients are below 2. And I straddle both IgE as well as non-IgE mediated allergy. One of the reasons I got into it, of course, I work in pediatrics, but is also that I could see the problem with diagnosis and often the recognition that was not optimal. And I could see the role that dietitians could play within that, and also the role within improving diets of these children. And lastly, I think it's very personal to me. I suffer from allergies myself, so I carry an adrenaline pen. So I think that is really where my passion for this topic starts.
Now, that's amazing. So you talked about having a clinical caseload. Are you involved in any other work, for example, with specialist groups, the British Dietetic Association or any other association?
Yeah. It's a great question. The answer is absolutely yes. I started off, I think it was almost for 12 years, I was the chair of the British Dietetic Association Specialist Group for Food Allergy. I've migrated out of that, handed over to very capable people, and I'm more now involved in the European Academy for Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and I'm the current chair for the Allied Health and Primary Care section. In fact, it's one of the biggest groups, almost 3,000 members. Wow. It's a great challenge. So it's more kind of an overview and trying to improve the education. But then I'm also involved within many charities within the UK. So I'm, for example, a trustee for ARFID Awareness, where I come with a pediatric side. I'm also with an Allergy UK anaphylaxis campaign. I'm looking at whatever they're writing. So from a scientific perspective, and also for FPIES UK, I'm heavily involved within those charities as well.
Amazing. So it definitely sounds like we are speaking to the right person. And I can already sense your passion for nutrition. In all the different roles that you've got going on, what are your specialist passion projects that you are involved in?
At the moment, I think passions move and change. At the moment, I would say my passion lies within undernutrition, so faltering growth, in particular allergy, cow's milk allergy, big part. And then I'm so passionate about feeding difficulties. And when I say feeding difficulties, the whole spectrum of feeding difficulties. So we have lots of projects coming out and task forces within EAACI, so actually a systematic review coming out. So I would say that at the moment is my passion, but you might talk to me in 5 years' time and it might be a different passion within food allergy.
Yeah, and it's great that your passions evolve. So if we do a little bit of a segue to talking about COMIS, am I pronouncing it right?
You're pronouncing it absolutely right.
Okay, so if we're segueing and talking about COMIS, let's unpack that a little bit so that we can get our listeners to really understand it. What does it actually stand for? What does the acronym COMIS stand for?
Yeah, it's cow's milk related symptom score. So cow's milk related symptom score. And yeah, we use it COMIS, and I think a lot of people forget what the acronym stands for because you see the cow's milk within that acronym already.
Okay. And when was it initially created?
So actually, it was already created in 2015 when the first group and under Professor Ivan van den Plas started to develop this symptom score. So it actually has a long history of now almost 8 years.
Okay. So it was 2015 you mentioned, and since 2015, it stayed the same or has it evolved and changed?
And that's something we'll talk about more, but actually that's the strength of COMIS. It has evolved, and it has evolved. In fact, we've updated in 2022, so last year. But something that you'll see throughout our discussion, whenever it evolves, it does not just evolve without any evidence. It's an evidence-based evolution of the symptom score. So yes, last year we've published an update, so 2022.
Okay. So it's recently been updated. Have you, in your various roles and in your different capacities and your different passions, been involved in the development or the updating of this score?
Yeah. So I would love to say I was involved in 2015, but no, not in 2015. But the core group with Professor Ivan van der Plas as the chair, and we've got from different countries, so like Hania Sajewska and Christophe Dupont from France, that has not changed, but I've been very fortunate to join the team in 2019. So I was very much involved in the updated version of 2022 and quite proud to be a dietitian within this team of allergists and gastroenterologists.
But crucial to have a dietitian there as well.
So I agree.
Let's go now into looking at COMIS in a little bit more detail and getting a broader overview and then also a detailed overview. So what is the absolute aim of COMIS?
So the absolute aim of COMIS is to raise awareness in patients where cow's milk allergy should be considered as a diagnosis. And please note, I'll use the terminology of raise awareness. This is not a diagnostic tool. So that is really the primary aim. There are smaller secondary aims, which I want to mention as well. So while that's the primary aim, we hope also to have a tool that reduces the time for healthcare professionals, that they have something they can use to shorten the clinic time, to really help the healthcare professionals. Whilst we raise awareness, it is really there also to support our colleagues and our healthcare professionals as a secondary aim as well.
Okay, so if we're looking at specific patient groups that the tool is designed for, what are the groups and why specifically those groups?
Yeah. So this I wanted to say, we all know that cow's milk allergies are diagnosed specifically in early childhood. And we see the vast majority of children are diagnosed within the first year of life, but particularly around the first 6 months of life, because cow's milk often is the first food that a child gets exposed to. That is something that we have with the update really specified and saying our primary aim group is children below the age of 1 year. Because that is the group where cow's milk is more prominent and where we see children present also. So below 1 year of life.
Okay. So if we then go to the diagnosis of cow's milk allergy, why is the diagnosis, particularly for non-IgE cow's milk allergy, so difficult for clinicians to get?
Linnea, it's a challenge that we always have. And it's such a reasonable challenge to have. You have to remember that symptoms like regurgitation, constipation, diarrhea, skin symptoms, respiratory symptoms are common in childhood per se. Okay. So if you think about, for example, a child having diarrhea, you think, gosh, a child could have a gastro bug, a child is vomiting outside having a bug, you know that the low esophageal sphincter pressure, often you have in early infancy dysregulation. So regurgitation often occurs. Then child can have a cough, a cold, a fever, and they get a rash, for example. Okay. So the challenge lies with what is normal with an early childhood and when can it be a cow's milk allergy? Yeah. And I think that's why, in particular, in non-IgE-mediated allergy. So just to clarify, non-IgE-mediated allergy is the delayed type allergy. So that means it can be the gastrointestinal skin symptoms or sometimes respiratory symptoms, but the symptoms can take up to 48 hours to develop. So you can imagine then how hard it is to link those symptoms to foods.
No. And I also remember hearing that one of the symptoms in terms of cow's milk allergy is also lots of crying, except crying. And children do that, right?
Yeah. And it's great you bringing that up. And we often think crying colic, and I'll talk a bit more when we talk about crying, but a colicky baby that cries a lot is very frequent, very common. But when do you say that crying is now excessive, if that makes sense?
Yeah. And I guess all the symptoms you've gone through, is that then all those symptoms are included in COMIS?
100%, 100%. And I think it's worth that you and me can walk through each one of these symptoms and think through each of these symptoms separately, because I think it's important for our listeners to understand not only why we've included them, but how are they scored within the COMIS?
Okay. Why don't we do that? Why don't we take one symptom out and then perhaps practically also, as you mentioned, look at how COMIS works in the scoring system. Over to you in terms of which symptom you want to start exploring first.
So first of all, I think it's important for me to mention, it's not only the podcast that our listeners will have, but there is a useful guide as a PDF, which you can download. So everything that I'm actually discussing today, you can also get in writing. So I think let's start with the crying, because we touched on colic before. And I want to say we used crying as a proxy marker for pain. Because we know that pain is commonly experienced. Now, when you look at the COMIS score, so some of you, the listeners, might be already quite used to the COMIS score. But for those of you that are not, each score has different number of scores, so up to 6, except for respiratory. So that means crying has up to 6 levels. So it's a 0 up to 6. And each level, we give you a score of severity. Now, the background to this is, many of our listeners know that the definition for colic would be defined as more than 3 hours of crying a day for at least 3 days during 1 week. We've used that principle and said, okay, so if you have a score of 0, it's less than 1 hour of crying per day.
And is that continuous crying, Rosanne?
Yeah. That's continuous crying. All children cry for short periods, but it's this continuous crying that just does not stop. And so that then goes up in our score. For example, the score of 2 is 1.5 to 2 hours of crying per day, continuous crying. And that goes up. It might seem impossible, but I do have at symptom 6, scoring 6, more than 5 hours of crying. You do see that.
Oh, my goodness.
It's really a proxy score for the amount of pain a child experiences.
Okay. So then you do that scoring for crying, and then would you do that the same for another score? So maybe talk me through another score.
Exactly. So I think let's go to the next score, and I think that is regurgitation. And regurgitation is really a complicated score to think about. Because what is regurgitation? Okay, because some people say, okay, Rosanne, that is reflux, or is it gastrophageal reflux disease? So we have used the term regurgitation just for feeds that visibly come up. Okay. Now, then the next question is, okay, great, but how much?
Aren't you meant to be burping babies anyway?
Exactly. And it was a challenge. And I want to say this regurgitation and all of those scores did not go without a lot of discussion. So when you look at the regurgitation, so first of all, we said the symptoms, like with the other symptoms, need to be present for more than 1 week, because a child that is sick can often vomit because they're sick. So you don't want to score if you're sick. But then we've tried to quantify it. A 0 is 0 to 2 episodes of regurgitation, which we see as normal because the Americans have a very nice term, spitting up. So zero would be 0 to 2 episodes per day, and then it goes up. And so we've tried to quantify that as a score of 1, it's more than 3 episodes, but less than 5 milliliters, that's a teaspoon. Now, again, we had that discussion, do you know what we're thinking? And I'm thinking around on a bib or a baby grow, you have these spots that are on there. But then it goes up where we have tried to quantify and say, have they got more episodes, and not only more episodes, but is it half of the feed or is it all of the feed? So the highest score, again, out of 6, is if a child regurgitates all of the feed after every feed.
Oh, goodness.
So that is important. It goes onto the severity. And you can see already where we're going, because we have a score for pain, crying. Mm. We've now got a score for regurgitation, bringing this up. So you'll start seeing how these combinations start building up.
Okay.
So I think, so we've got the pain, we've got the regurgitation. I think, therefore, as we are still busy with the gut, it's quite good to think, because regurgitation is a gut symptom.
Yeah.
To also think about the lower part, you know, the stools.
Yeah.
And I think with the stools, this is an important consideration because we've recently changed, for those of you, the listeners who've used the Comus stool before, we've changed from using the Bristol stool to the BITS, which is the Brussels Infant and Toddler School Scale. The reason for the change was just because that's a validated score for non-potty trained infants. We want them non-potty trained because remember we discussed that the children primarily present within the first year of life. So you're not expecting a potty trained child there. Now, like all the other scores, so we already know the rhythm, it's out of six.
Yeah.
And I do suggest to our listeners that they actually go and look at the BITS, because what I will explain now is going to sound very abstract, but BITS has got lovely photos of every stool. So we've got type 1, 2, and 3. These are really hard stools. To describe it, goes from rabbit droppings, small rabbit droppings, to a hard sausage. But that's the one spot.
One end.
Yeah, exactly. That we would then score at 4, and a nicely formed soft stool, which we've got a photo of, is a 0. And then we go to the other end, which is 4 is a type 5 and type 6. It's like a porridge stool, if I may say so. And then we go, the highest score really is 2 watery stool that is totally synced into the nappy.
Okay.
I think this is really improved from what we've got before, because the photos are within the nappy itself, so you can really see.
Okay.
So we've gone through pain marker, we've gone through the gut regurgitation, we've gone through stools, but a primary symptom also is the skin.
Okay.
And within skin, we have, I want to categorize into 2 skin symptoms. We have the eczema type skin symptoms, and we have the urticaria or the angioedema. I am going to start with the eczema type symptoms because, again, we have scoring here for the eczema type symptoms. Now, for that, remember, it's still out of 6, but because we've got 2 parts, we've got the eczema, and then we've got the immediate type urticaria and the angioedema. The eczema, we've got different areas here. And here, again, it will sound very abstract, but we actually provide the users a score.
Yeah.
Look at the face, the trunk, if it's all over. And so you can't just say, oh, it's mild to moderate by visualization. We actually show a chart of the whole body.
To give that comparison.
Exactly. Exactly. So again, it's to make it more visual. Of course, the chart, if you've got it all over the body, of course, you'll come to scoring to 6 at the end. But it's this is very important. And I think we've had in the past often heard people just going, oh, it's in the face. It looks just quite severe in the face. Oh, it's quite severe. So our score is 6. But actually, if we go just and say the eczema is in the face and head and trunk, it would be a much lower score than having it generalized all over the body.
Of course.
Okay. So that's one part. The second part is the urticaria and the angioedema. Now, again, I want to highlight angioedema, which is the swelling, more profound, deeper swelling, often around the eyes, the lip areas, was not part of the previous Comus score. But we've decided to actually include it just because we have found that in the past, the distinguishing between angioedema and urticaria, so urticaria is really the hives, often they flow into each other. So we wanted to be reflective, and these are very typical of an IgE-mediated cow smoke allergy. Now, here, I want to say it's much simpler. Okay? It's much simpler. It's either a yes or a no.
Okay.
If it's a no, it's a 0. If it's a yes, it's a 6.
Okay. Okay. So you got 2 scores then coming out from the skin, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And I think from skin perspective, it is a topic that often causes confusion. That's why it's really important. Have a look at the tool itself and see it. But you'll have it seen in the eczema side and then the angioedema and urticaria. That is together. It can be both or it can be one of them. But that's a yes or a no. So a no, angioedema, or both are not present. No, 0. And yes, present, a 6.
Okay. Any other symptoms to add in there? So we've done skin.
Absolutely. So we've done skin, we've done gut, we've done pain. Now it's the respiratory symptoms. So around 20 to 30% of children with cow's milk allergy do have respiratory symptoms.
Didn't you realize was that high?
Yes, actually it is. We often have discussions around the etiology, but that's a different podcast, I think, and a different discussion around that. But this is one difference. Unlike the other scores where we go 0 to 6, this one is 0 to 3. Okay. And again, the first proviso is, of course, you want to make sure that the child does not have a normal seasonal cough or cold. Okay, so you're not going to score. So that has to be taken into account. So you rule out they don't have a seasonal cough or cold. And here we say the symptoms are chronic cough, runny nose, wheezing. Now, they can be one of them or any of them, but there's either no respiratory symptoms, slight symptoms, mild symptoms, severe symptoms. And here it is the discretion of your healthcare professional, because a chronic cough or runny nose, it can be runny nose on a daily basis, or it can be runny nose 3 or 4 times a week. There is some discretion to score this. But therefore, you can see the weighting is not as heavy in terms of the score.
Yeah. So what is, from all of these symptoms, you're going to have an overall score, which you then calculate. So what's the maximum possible overall score? What's the minimum? And when does a clinician have to start thinking, okay, we need to do something?
Absolutely. So goes up to 33. Goes up to 33, 0 or 33. The cutoff that we have adjusted to in 2022, anything from 10 and above, would be increasing your awareness and saying, oh, this may be cow's milk allergy. I need to start the process of considering this as a diagnosis. And then the clinician needs to decide, okay, am I going to start the diagnostic process? Okay. So it's really above from 10 and above below 6. It is unlikely that this is related to cow's milk allergy. So other diagnoses need to be taken into account for that.
Okay. And what about 6 to 10?
Yeah, 6 to 10. I often have this discussion. So I think the best way to explain it to anybody listening to us talking, within IgE-mediated allergy, you've got tests, skin prick tests, and you have cutoffs that are, this is a 95% confidence interval. You definitely have a cow's milk allergy, but then you have an in-between group where you need to challenge and use your clinical discretion. So this is really a 6 to 9 for me in that same category to say, whilst it's unlikely, it still does not mean we rule out cow's milk allergy as a differential diagnosis in our head. And this is why it's so important that you want to have this awareness tool in a group of people that actually have a clinical background, so healthcare professionals, that they can put the puzzle together with other puzzle pieces.
Yeah.
So for me as a healthcare professional, for example, if I had a score of 6 to 9, we don't talk about feeding difficulties, for example. But if you've got severe feeding difficulties as a healthcare professional, I'll go, actually, I might consider this also as a diagnosis. You might have a healthcare professional with a different background to go. So it's all about saying a 10 and above, it's more likely, and you'd want to really increase the awareness, saying this is pushes you up into the likelihood of a cow's milk allergy. But I think 6 to 9 is one of that category where the healthcare professional, that clinical history plays a very important role, and they might be as lucky to have than other tests also. If you've got very mild symptoms, then you might think, okay, I'm going to do a skin prick test and see whether that might be increasing the likelihood for a cow's milk allergy diagnosis.
Yeah, no, that makes absolute sense. You have done a wonderful job at giving us an overview of COMIS. Is there anything else that you want to add to that?
Before we talk about the evidence, I do want to hover just around again that we spoke about the patients that to use it for, and that's below the age of 1. But I think also we're very specific in our COMIS guidance that we say this is in the hands of a healthcare professional. So we want it really for a healthcare professional. And you've heard me now saying the clinical history is absolutely critical in the discretion of a healthcare professional. I think that with an awareness tool, that always should be said, it should be in the right hands.
Absolutely. And it's really important because it really helps facilitate putting together the different pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah. I think one topic that we didn't touch on most probably, if you do have a score from of 10 and above, what would be the next process? And I think the diagnostic process is also key as a healthcare professional. So we would say 2 to 4 week elimination diet. And I'm hoping here that our dietitian would shine here in supporting an elimination diet. I would never suggest an elimination diet without thinking about the implication of removing cow's milk from whether that's mother and the child's diet. You need to think what you're replacing with. And I think that's really important. But even more important is the reintroduction. Your diagnostic process is not completed until a reintroduction has occurred. And so I think that also needs to be reiterated, is that the diagnostic process is part of the awareness. So we raise awareness, you do a diagnostic process, and within the diagnostic process, it's the reintroduction to confirm your diagnosis or actually to say, no, it's not cow's milk allergy.
Okay, no, that's a really important point to touch on. I'm going to try and move over now and talk about evidence. What is, in a world where we are focusing more on evidence-based medicine, what research is there behind the use, the application of COMIS?
Yeah.
Are you aware of any published studies?
Actually, not any. There are 25 published studies at the moment, which include validation studies, which include also the application of different population, different countries, because I think the language also in different countries is so critical. And as we're speaking, I know we are busy with further publications. So as it stands, we've got 25 publications. And I think that's really exciting and unique to COMIS, that it is an evidence-based process.
Brilliant. And I guess all the research that keeps happening also then has implications on what aspects of the score get updated.
100%. And as I said at the beginning, nothing gets adjusted without there being the evidence. And when we have the evidence, in for example, the last round, we reviewed the evidence. And then outside of that, we then had a kind of a modified eDelphi process where we have a consensus because there is evidence. And then we have to also reach amongst us consensus around the weight that we put to the evidence. So we went through several rounds before we actually came to this modified version of the COMIS.
And then in your own clinical practice, and I guess with all the different colleagues that you work with in your different roles, what is the impact of using COMIS successfully?
So I use it, my experiences in different domains. So I use it for myself to kind of make sure that I've not missed anything. And I think that's also great for a dietitian to use. But I have really been heavily involved because as within the UK setting that I worked, we have a strong primary care setting. And that primary care setting is also time limited. So that means consultations need to be as time effective as possible. And so I think that has been where I really see the strength is for that limitation in really being effective and highlighting it and creating awareness. Because within the primary care, you can imagine the amount of diagnoses you need to think about. Within the patients that come through the door, they'll have just normal colic, they'll just have diarrhea, things like that. So I think that's really where COMIS within the primary care setting, certainly where I've been exposed to, comes to its own.
Yeah. And you mentioned obviously the use of COMIS with dietitians. Are there any other particular healthcare professionals that you feel COMIS would have the most impact with?
Lynelle, primary care, whatever your healthcare setting, the first responders, if I may call it like that, whether that's in a European country, which often is a pediatrician where the parents come to as first responders. But I can, there are so many other healthcare professionals that I think outside of dietitians and GPs, but within a UK settings, it's health visitors as well as a, you know, where it can be. And I think that's really important to see who are our first responders within healthcare professionals that have been trained that where this. And I think there, every country should look who sees the children first. And I think that is really where you want to focus on these using COMIS.
No, I couldn't agree even more. Roseanne, I've heard that you're going to be presenting some really interesting data about the use of different scores. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, you've heard correct. So it's at an upcoming conference. So what we've tried to do with a group that is largely different to the COMIS group, We've put a group of healthcare professionals straddling primary, secondary, and tertiary care from actually all different countries. So Europe, and we've got US. But so we've looked at what is available. So if a healthcare professional was going to on Google now, and they were going cow's milk allergy questionnaire, we've used the term questionnaire tools and score as search term, what would they find? And then what we've done is we've looked at the evidence for each, and that of course includes the COMIS as well. And then based on that, we had a Delphi within these healthcare professionals to come up with consensus to provide healthcare professionals all over the world with guidance. How do you work with questionnaires or like the COMIS when you've got them available? How do you use them in clinical practice? What is the positive and what is the negative of using these questionnaires? We hope that will really add on to the practicality of using the tools that are currently available, and in particular also how healthcare professionals should use COMIS.
I imagine that would be very valuable.
I hope so.
As we draw our conversation to a close, what would you say your main takeaways are in regards to COMIS?
My main takeaway would be for any listener to say there is a score, and it's an awareness score. It is heavily evidence-based, and it is led by a group of healthcare professionals that work in this area, so they have clinical experience. It is a score that is alive. What I mean there, it is constantly changing, but whenever it changes, we make sure that there is the evidence backed up to it. And then I think another very important message is it's an awareness tool. It's not a diagnostic tool. Yes. And it is best used in the hands of a healthcare professional. So I hope, I think I've got most of
those are very clear points. Yeah, no. And is there anything else important that you want to share with our health professionals that could help them improve their practice now?
So I think outside of using the score, I think what I want to share with anybody that's listening to this is that it's a conversation that goes in all directions. So we do welcome feedback, and I think we welcome different environments to using this score. So if there's anybody listening saying we've been using it, and it's in a different country and you've not been using it, we welcome research, we welcome collaboration. And I think that's an important message for anybody listening to our discussion today, to say, use it, tell us what your experience is, and come back. We are open and prepared for further research.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic way to end the podcast. Rosanne, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure to discuss this very important topic.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Medical Nutrition. If you enjoyed the podcast and found the content useful, please share it with your colleagues. And consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. For more information on this topic or to share your feedback, please visit the Nestle Health Science N+ Hub or click on the link in the show notes.